Hello and welcome to this next in the Innovation Forum Ethical Trade and Human Rights webinar series. Starting off, some of the conversations we had hoped to be having in person in London today and tomorrow, and teeing things up for when we meet later in the year. I'm Ian Welsh and I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so. So far today, we've discussed the evolving legislative landscape and also supply chain risk mapping. Right now, we're going to be talking about supplier engagement and training and how to scale programs across supply chains to drive greater understanding and impact. And I'm delighted to be joined by Shane Tyler, Group Compliance Director with Fresca Group, and Sarah Carpenter, Manager of Business and Human Rights with Ascent Compliance. I will shortly invite our panelists to answer some opening questions to get us started. We also have some follow-up Q&A, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions. Please submit questions using the box in the webinar dashboard and I will put them to our panel. The usual standing request, please try and keep your questions short and to the point, and if you do, it is more likely that I will use them. We are recording the audio and you will receive a link to this in due course for you to listen to again and to share with your colleagues. Okay, Shane, perhaps you could outline what Fresca does and your perspective on how the challenges engaging suppliers are changing. What does a good training program look like? Shane.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Shane Tyler. I'm the Group Compliance Director for a large fruit and veg supply called Fresca. But frankly, my name or the company that I work for, I've learnt over the years, is irrelevant. The supply chains are fundamentally the same, and where my expertise generally sits in worker welfare issues, they don't care about which supply chain it is. I've spent most of my career though in operations and managing the immediate operational demands of several businesses since the early 90s. In 2000, the factory I was managing at the time, which wasn't a Fresca facility, was on BBC's Panorama for the illegal employment of over 200 staff. We didn't know at the time that we had an issue and we didn't do anything wrong. I would argue that we probably didn't do enough. And we've been infiltrated by a criminal gang. Subsequent investigations following that airing of the programme identified that workers were on as little as 70 pence per hour, and we had evidence of sexual exploitation being unearthed. We began a programme of prevention within the facility. And at the time, I soon learned that we had a lack of resources, knowledge, commitment that was available to me. I also learned very quickly that the real experts were not us. They're those that perpetrate the crime in our supply chain, in our business. As we progressed, we became more successful, though, and following moves to other businesses and other ethical cultures that I experienced that were more aligned, we began to see change in the behaviour of the exploiters. And it moved out of our businesses and into our supply chains. The challenge to tackle this was changing and becoming more difficult. And I found, though, that the initial principles hadn't changed. We still had to get the same business mindset right. We still had to implement the same, the right systems. And we also needed to develop our business to reach a level of maturity that was able to really openly talk about the challenge. I've also found that the suppliers in principle haven't changed over the 20 years. They're still in four brackets as far as we describe it. There's the group, the unaware, the unable, the unwilling, and the compliant. Specific to worker exploitation related matters, we've learned over the past 20 years how to scale programs across the supply chain to drive a greater understanding. However, our greatest frustration remains that scale of the challenge. But this, I suppose, is managed by the business mindset that I spoke earlier. So you asked what are the challenges engaging suppliers and what does a good training program look like? Well, if I do that in reverse order, good training program from our experiences, probably let's ask the experts. If you were to ask a teacher what their number one priority is, they would say student welfare. If you ask a teacher what success looks like, they would probably say to maximize the effectiveness of each and every learner. Well, creating a safe environment for those in your supply chain to be trained is crucial. It also enables free and open communication. And therefore, it's our first priority to manage the protocols to enable that supply chain to be open and honest. The second is to accept that success is not going to be a perfection for everyone, simply unachievable. But if we can maximize progress based on the each supplier and their needs, then that's a good step to take. And of those four sections that we looked at, or I mentioned, the unaware, well, let's make them aware, let's teach them. The unable, understand what capacity is required and support it, support their individual learning needs. The unwilling, find out why they're unwilling, find out what it is that needs to make them engage. Walking away may be an option, but it should be the last. The compliant, we need to help them realize that there is always room for improvement. And from a teacher's perspective, there's probably always the bright kids in the class. We just need to stretch their ability. How the challenges with the suppliers are changing? Well, the suppliers never stay still. Their needs and challenges, awareness, etc., are always evolving. Likewise, the exploiters are always adapting. And it's about how you share that information effectively. To get around that, probably the most successful thing has been our networks and therefore post-training information that comes out of those networks. And in the last 12 calendar months, we've identified a significant number of issues. Of the last 25 cases out of our supply chain, 20 were internally identified and the other 5 from external networks. So if you get the training right in a safer environment, the information also comes back up to help you manage your supply chain. And I've worked on the basis that a good plan today is better than that perfect one tomorrow. And yeah, hopefully I've covered off your question.
No, thank you, Shane. Thank you very much. That's a fantastic start to our discussion. Given it's... I think let's talk about the elephant in the room. In terms of what you're doing with your suppliers, how is that working around the coronavirus crisis? How is that affecting what you're doing? And also thinking in terms of the, you know, the most vulnerable in your supply chain are going to be impacted by this as much as anyone.
Well, the food industry, we have to feed the nation. So we're keeping on going. So in terms of operational activity, it's not immediately changing. So my activities before the webinar today were the same as I would have been doing 2 or 3 weeks ago, where I'm looking at the same KPIs and looking at the same information, and we're managing our supply chain as if it's a normal day. Of course, it's unprecedented times, and it's not. And we've got some challenges in terms of size of orders and other aspects. But we're doing everything that we can to manage and protect our workforce and liaise and work with and protect our supply chain.
Sure. Okay. Thinking in terms of the go back to engaging with your supply chain and training impacts and everything else, how much of an impact does price have? How conscious are you of ensuring that there is the value throughout the supply chain that it enables the sort of good practices that you require?
Yeah, that's a hot question. Thank you. it's always very difficult because actually good ethics in a supply chain should be free, but that is different to whether it should be valued. And of course, actually delivering it to the complexity that we do or businesses have to deliver it to these days cannot be done free. But there's not necessarily a value that's assigned to it. And as we drive prices lower, that causes more and more challenges for those with the tightest margins. It's a very difficult balance because it's hard to condone the behaviour of somebody that cuts the corner. But if a farmer has a stark choice to losing his business or cutting a corner, which one are they going to do? And sometimes we have to question the root cause of how we got ourselves to that circumstance. But generally, by working with and helping suppliers understand, they don't tend to go do those corner cutting. the vast majority of suppliers are good suppliers. They are not the criminals that are exploiting people. The people that are exploiting them are the criminals, and we often forget that in business.
Sure. Thanks very much, Shane, and we'll come back to some of those points a little bit later. Let me bring in Sarah Carpenter now. Sarah, perhaps you can reflect on what is best practice at the companies you're working with, and how the challenges differ cross sector for you. Sarah.
Yeah, certainly, of course. Thanks, Ian. So I will focus my remarks primarily on what I'm going to call kind of virtual engagement with suppliers. So this is supplier engagement outside the context of in-person kind of on-site meetings, because it's an important aspect of programs in order to bring them to scale, which is an important a focus of today's session. And so businesses, you know, are engaging with their suppliers virtually in order to collect data from them, let's say, to understand risks in their supply chain. So which of their, you know, to better understand the characteristics of the supplier's workforce, for instance, where the work is actually taking place, not just where the supplier is billing their clients or where the supplier's headquarters is located. Or maybe, you know, businesses are engaging with their suppliers to assign improvement plans so that they can strengthen their management system so that their workers are protected from human rights abuses. And so, you know, Ascent Compliance, we're in the business of supplier engagement. We've been doing this for almost 10 years. We've engaged with over 300,000 suppliers on our clients' behalf. And we've certainly seen that there's, you know, a range of strategies that time and time have again have shown to be very effective when it comes to increasing supplier engagement rates. And so I wanted to primarily focus, I guess, my introductory remarks on what some of those strategies are. I've identified three of them. So the first one that I want to draw attention to is the importance of leveraging industry standard supplier engagement tools where they do exist. And so where possible, to shy away from developing and launching company specific tools, and instead where they exist, to give preference to industry standard supplier engagement tools. And there's actually some metrics that I wanted to introduce to help give context why you know, this is so important from a supplier engagement perspective. And this actually comes from one of our clients. They're in the medical device industry, and they've been tracking the number of requests that they receive every year from their clients. They've been tracking it from since 2014, and they've actually made projections for the future. And so just to give your audience a sense of how this has changed and evolved over time, in 2016, they received 124 requests from their clients. This jumped to over 1,500 in 2019. So it shows the importance of leveraging industry standard tools to ease the burden on suppliers in order to encourage their engagement in programs, given the growing number of requests that they're receiving from their clients on a yearly basis. And these tools, of course, they have advantages outside the context of actually increasing supplier engagement rates. They're often supported by multi-stakeholder initiatives, so businesses can have confidence that a range of perspectives were taken into consideration in the development of these tools. They're often updated at a regular cadence, so again, businesses have confidence that they're keeping stride with ever-evolving industry needs. They're often transparent, so when businesses disclose their use in their public disclosure statements, their readers have confidence in being, you know, being able to evaluate the tools and seeing that they're robust. When industry standard tools are leveraged, suppliers are then empowered to leverage those same tools within their own due diligence programs. So in that way, businesses are then empowering their suppliers to address risks in the deeper tiers of their supply chains. And these tools are often, you know, tested and piloted widely, adopted widely. And so that means that they're, you know, defensible. If a business were to ever face an inquiry from, let's say, an external body, they can point to the fact that their programs are aligned to industry practice, which can serve as an important defense. There's a number of tools that jump to mind for me, and I you know, I'm sure your audience would be able to add to the list. One is the conflict minerals reporting template. There's now the cobalt reporting template. So those are tools that businesses are using to identify smelters of high concern within their supply chains. We've certainly been very involved in the Social and Labor Convergence Program, which is an initiative specific to the apparel and footwear sector for now. where they've launched, again, an industry standard self-assessment questionnaire that apparel businesses can use to engage their suppliers on social and labor issues. And then in the context of modern slavery issues, there's the STRT, or the Slavery and Trafficking Risk Template, which businesses are using today to understand risks in their supply chain as it relates to modern slavery risks. So again, there are, you know, I do see some gaps in what's available for businesses from a tool perspective, but I do think it's important to consider which tools are available and to leverage those where possible within programs in order to increase supplier engagement rates, just given the significant increase in requests that suppliers are receiving, over time. The second key strategy that I wanted to bring forward is, and I think actually this complements nicely with some of Shane's remarks around supplier education, which is, you know, proactive supplier education. So again, to help reinforce the difference that this really can make from a supplier engagement perspective, I want to highlight the experience of two of our clients, one of which was very proactive in their supplier engagement efforts, and the other was less so. They're comparable businesses. So in this case, they're both from the aerospace and defense sector. They're both very large businesses, so over $5 billion in revenue per year. And they were both looking to engage their suppliers to understand the presence of hazardous substances within their supply chains. One of them launched their supplier engagement program or efforts on this particular subject by starting off with a webinar. So again, this is a very scalable tool that businesses can use to educate their suppliers on, in this case, hazardous substances. So the business used this opportunity to articulate the importance of this topic to their suppliers, to help clarify some of the drivers, to give suppliers clarity on how they can engage with their clients on this particular topic. And they also fielded questions from their suppliers. So in this case, they actually received 30 unique questions from their supply base, which really enabled them to proactively address any of the barriers that their suppliers might have faced in order to engage with them on this particular topic. So that organization who embedded a webinar within their program received over 80% engagement rate from their suppliers. And that's in contrast to the business, again, you know, same sector, same size, same topic, who didn't leverage a webinar. Their engagement rates were half of that. They were 40%. So again, it just shows how there really can be a significant jump in engagement rates when businesses are being proactive and strategic with how they educate their suppliers. The third strategy that I wanted to, you know, put on the table and highlight is, again, the importance of speaking the same language as suppliers. And again, I can, you know, highlight the importance of this through the context of the experience of one of our clients who was engaging their suppliers on conflict mineral issues. And in 2015, they did an English-only engagement with their suppliers on those topics. But in 2016, they tried something different. They actually engaged, segregated their suppliers by language and engaged their suppliers using the primary language of their suppliers. And again, it should be no surprise that they saw a sizable increase in engagement rates from their suppliers. So among their German suppliers, when it was in English, their engagement rates were at about 40%. This jumped to 69% when the engagement in the following year was made in the German language. And then among their Japanese suppliers, actually, it went from 0% when it was in English to 17% when it was in Japanese. So that's probably still not where they'd want, the final engagement rate to go. But it does highlight, again, the sort of jump in engagement rates in this context. The only difference was use of language. So I wanted to start with some of those tips and strategies that we've really seen our clients employ effectively within their own programs and you know, the sizable impact that can have on supplier engagement rates as well as on companies' ability to scale their programs. And I'm happy to continue the discussion.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Sarah. Audience, do submit your questions. They're starting to come in, but I'm hoping to use your questions and put them to our panelists in the second half, certainly, of our session. So do be thinking about your questions and submit them using the questions box. But Sarah, yes, you mentioned the importance of using industry standard tools. And I do want to I will ask Shane about that in a second. You listed some tools as well. I guess for a lot of companies, a big problem is picking the right tool to use and thinking around what are the characteristics of the tools that they should be looking for. So from your perspective, Sarah, what do you think that, or what would you recommend that companies look for when they're considering using tools to engage with their suppliers around these your human rights issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. So certainly I think an important, I guess, value to take into consideration is industry adoption. So how well used is the tool, and what is the feedback on the tool for those businesses who have leveraged it? So many organizations who introduce, you know, these tools to the market, they accompany them with case studies or profiles of businesses who have leveraged those tools within their own programs, where they're giving a reflection on the value that that tool would have brought to their programs. So certainly I would take into consideration industry adoption, as well as consider who has adopted those tools and what has been their experience. I would look for other characteristics. Again, you know, is there, you know, multi-stakeholder perspectives? Were they taken into consideration in the development of the tool? Again, is there a commitment to ensuring that those tools remain up to date? I mean, I know modern slavery continues to be a pressing concern for businesses. It's a topic where new learning is emerging all the time in terms of really what's most effective when it comes to engaging suppliers on these issues. And the legal and regulatory landscape, as we would have heard earlier today, is ever evolving. And so it's then, you know, it compels the organization that's maintaining those tools to ensure that they're keeping stride with those new developments. Again, ensure that the tool is transparent. I would also actually, an important point is the tool open source? And that can really be important when it comes to the tool's ability to empower suppliers to leveraging the tool themselves within their own programs, so that the business is kind of setting an example for the types of tools that a supplier can use and adopt themselves.
Thanks. So that's some great advice there. Shane, I wonder if I could put that to you. For you, I mean, it was the first of the strategies that Sarah mentioned, the importance of leveraging industry standard tools. How much do you recognize that in your business and your supply chains?
They're a very important measure. So whether that be self-assessment questionnaires, the audit programs that take place, some of the toolkits that have, and there are numerous that have been launched, they all follow a very, very similar theme. They're great because they help give you an insight into where that business perceives it is, that supplier perceives that they are. One of the caveats that we tend to do as part of our training is then help the suppliers realize that if they're already, the tool that they are following, the exploiters are already aware of it. So if you were to do a certain training program which required a certain recruitment standard and the certain questions you would ask at recruitment, those that are trying to infiltrate your business are already one step ahead of the game. I'll give you an example of that. If an exploiter is trying to get into your business, what they're actually doing is they are looking out for the signs of exploitation that we're looking for. And a sign of exploitation is the presence of abnormal. And because it's present and it's abnormal, the exploiters can hide it from us. So an example would be, as part of a toolkit, does your systems have in place systems to check for houses of multiple occupancy? That's a UK-based synopsis. Well, yes, you would have that system in place and you would tick that box to say, yes, we do that. But the exploiter already knows you're looking for that. So they're only sending you two people from that address. So therefore, they're hiding that sign from you. So we help the suppliers to go that step further regarding their toolbox or their toolkits to look behind them to help understand, are they really understanding the risks in their supply chain and what other mitigations are they doing? So we encourage them to look for the absence of normal, get training programs deep into their supply chain so that it's the people standing next to the most vulnerable that are aware of the risks, so that they've also got the reporting mechanism to get the intel fed through. And as a direct result of that, we do get a lot of intelligence fed through our business and our supply chain of issues which we're then able to share with the authorities and start tackling in the local areas.
I guess the answer really is you've got to know your supply chain, and anything that can help you to do that is only going to help.
It is, but the size of the challenge is massive. And one of the things that we do with the protocols with working with our supply chain is we're immediately on their side. If I get a phone call from a supplier to say that they found a problem, normally the first words that follow it are congratulations, well done. Because if I don't create the safe environment for them to report, they won't report. The second part that comes with that is we encourage them to treat levels of exploitation as if it's speeding of a car. Now, we couldn't ask the police to stop speeding. It's just not going to happen. We're not in control of those that wish to exploit our supply chain. What we can do, though, is we can put in speed humps. We can put in speed cameras. We can make it difficult to speed so that they go speed somewhere else. And if everybody does it, then eventually we might reach the utopia of nobody speeding. But the principle being that we're helping them to manage their supply chain so they go somewhere else, and that they put in the systems, and that's what toolkits are very good at. They implement the standards and systems that help them create the hurdles to send them somewhere else who don't have those systems.
Great, thanks very much, Shane. Sarah, I turn to you. A question coming in from our audience. What do you think around setting a minimum score for suppliers to achieve in a rating system such as the one EcoVadis have? Minimum scores, what do you think?
I would be cautious about setting any minimum score, certainly in the first year of a program, for instance. So the general advice that I tend to give for our clients when they're first engaging with their suppliers on human rights issues, modern slavery issues, is that they consider it to be their baseline. And they, you know, it's crucial at that stage, again, to set the right tone with their suppliers, completely in alignment with what Shane was saying. So really the pillars that are most important here is looking to foster a culture of transparency with suppliers, as well as a culture of continuous improvement. And if suppliers feel or believe that they're expected to be perfect, then that can actually hinder an engagement rates and an effective addressing of the issues. So I would be, you know, if there's any sort of minimum score that a business is looking to set for their suppliers, I would be cautious about doing it in the first year of the program. Maybe in later years of the program, once they've really set that culture of transparency, of continuous improvement, where their suppliers are equipped and empowered to make changes within their system so that their workers are protected from human rights violations, then that's maybe where those minimum scores could start to enter the conversations. But I certainly would discourage it, when a program is first being launched.
Thank you very much. We've got a lot of questions coming in on auditing. Inevitably, audits always are always a hot topic in these sort of sessions. So, Sarah, staying with you for a second, what for you in the context of these issues, what for you is a good auditing framework, or what does a good auditing framework specifically look like?
Mm-hmm. I mean, what jumps to mind for me, you know, in terms of audits is, so I guess I'll you know, maybe start by highlighting that I started my career in the apparel sector. So, I really launched into the space of business and human rights. I was living and working in Bangladesh for the UN's International Labour Organization, supporting the collapse to Rana Plaza. And so it's a sector, that I became familiar with quite early in my career that, leverages audits, right? It's quite common for, apparel businesses to use audits to a degree that now that I have experience with other sectors, medical device, aerospace and defense and others who maybe leverage audits to not to the same frequency as a company would if they were in the apparel sector, for instance. So, you know, the first thing to note, and this, you know, everyone on the line I'm sure would know, is that there are, you know, while audits certainly bring a lot of value to programs, there are, you know, well-known limitations to them, right? So they do need to be used strategically. And I guess what I'm starting to see, and in fact, this is also, you know, bearing out in the apparel sector, is efforts that companies are using to engage with their suppliers virtually in advance of an on-site audit. And they're doing so in an effort to scale their programs, right? Because on-site audits, they take a lot of resources. So they're smartly using virtual supplier engagement tools in order to help drive change and awareness in their supply chain in advance of an in-person visit. So what I've heard, for instance, one company sort of had brought it to my attention that their general approach is to use, if it's a self-assessment questionnaire or risk evaluation tool, work with their suppliers to bring their systems up to a good standard. And then once they've done that virtually, they then focus their on-site audits onto those suppliers and then verify that their systems are in fact at the level to which they've disclosed in their self-assessment questionnaire tools or risk assessment tools. And so that's kind of what comes to mind for me in terms of where I see kind of audit frameworks generally going is leveraging, again, these virtual tools to start and then really strategically focusing audits in the areas of supply chain, once that change in awareness really is driven so that the verification can occur.
Thanks very much. Shane, a related question for you. Do you think that factory training is at risk of becoming the new auditing in that, you know, everyone's doing it, but no one really knows if it's working? Do you think that's the case? And how? What are the kind of ways of guarding against that?
Can you just repeat the first part of the question again,
sure,
please?
The question is really around, is training program, is there a risk of training in factories and with suppliers becoming the new auditing, if you like? Everyone's doing it, but no one's really sure how well it's working. Do you think that's the case, and how? What's the way of guarding against that?
I think there's actually a space for both, because if you're the while audits are not perfect, they are a good benchmark and a snapshot in time of where that supplier is. They don't stop exploitation; they just tell you whether you've got the relevant systems and potential barriers. Where training can be good, if it's delivered to the right levels, is it can actually be a real deterrent, because if training is delivered to the lowest levels, then it can be very effective. I tend to find if a business just does their manager's training, it's not good enough. The exploitation is happening at the lowest levels in businesses, in our suppliers, and we want the people at those lowest levels to identify it and have the reporting mechanisms in place so that we can then go and tackle it. If you then start making it an uncomfortable place for the exploiters to operate, they will go elsewhere. When you're just doing top level management training and it's not filtering down to where the issue is, it has limited impact. And I think that's probably one of the problems with audits when they try and do worker interviews. Worker interviews fail because the people in the main part, I'm not saying that they're not successful in some areas, but in the main part, they might have a 1%, 5% rate where a worker would tell you something in a worker interview. That's not a good enough acceptable level for me. I would prefer not to have any worker interviews at all, but ensure that those standing next to the worker in a supply chain has had some level of training to look after their welfare. And that's one of the things that we do in our organization. We treat health and safety as it should be treated. And it's, if you read the first line of the 1974 UK Modern Health and Safety at Work Act, it states that a business must put in provision for the health, safety and welfare of employees. And we need to treat the welfare part as much as an importance as we treat health and safety. Sure. And then if you're delivering that as everybody's responsibility, it starts generating results.
Sure. No, thank you. Thanks, Shane. Got a related question. And in fact, I'll put it to Sarah first, and then I'll come back to you, Shane, if I may. And it's a very good point in that procurement teams are often faced with conflicting priorities, looking for savings versus doing the right things for the suppliers. So, Sarah, firstly, what's your view on how procurement teams can become better equipped to make sound commercial decisions at the same time as ensuring an ethical supply chain?
Mm-hmm. So what jumps to mind for me really is, I think, and that's certainly an issue that's often raised, right, is sort of the need to balance, of course, costs, on-time delivery, quality with, you know, ethical concerns as well. Maybe the point that I would bring forward is, you know, how important it is that businesses really do take a holistic look at cost. So in the context of modern slavery issues, for instance, today, it is in the US, the US Customs and Border Protection Agency, they have grounds to stop a good from accessing the US market if it was made wholly or in part using forced labor. And, you know, I have an example, for instance, of a business who was caught in the hairs of that particular law. And they saw a 13.4% drop in their sales because they lost access to the US market over a period of, I believe it was 6 months. And so that shows how those broader cost considerations aren't often considered when it comes to balancing sort of cost with ethics. So, you know, I would encourage businesses to really look at the bigger picture and not just consider kind of cost as it relates to that particular good, but the broader ramifications of what a human rights violation, the impact, broader financial impact that it could have on a business in terms of significant market access disruptions, supply chain disruptions, reputational risks, you know, all the things that we all know well. So yeah, that's certainly something that I would put on the table.
Shane, do you want to comment on that as well? I mean, how do you balance or how do you think the balance can best be made between commercial decisions and ensuring an ethical supply chain? And how can you make the decisions to have them both at the same time?
Yeah, it's a very difficult challenge. The crucial thing first off is to at least get it on the piece of paper. Very often going to suppliers and in their supply chains, it's not even considered. So the first thing is it needs to be as a pillar to at least be measured. And then it's about developing that level of measurement on that piece of paper so that it moves up the decision tree. If you're then in a delicate decision, do I go with supplier A or supplier B, but it's on the piece of paper and supplier A ethically is much stronger, then it will start swaying. If it's not on the paper at all, you could make the wrong decision. So we've always encouraged our procurement teams to have that, but it's a very difficult challenge because even though it should be free, it's not. It costs money to have an audited supply chain. It costs money to employ people that are looking at the ethics within a business, and it's an unlevel playing field for some of the businesses that aren't doing any of that when it comes to the procurement decision. So it is something that needs to be considered.
Sure. No, thank you. Thank you, Shane. Slightly change of subject. Back to Sarah. Several questions about the virtual engagement tools, which are, I guess, right now, people are thinking about doing lots of things virtually. But Sarah, could you just give us some further thought around examples of good virtual engagement tools, and perhaps any case studies you could point at that give a good example of how to do virtual supplier engagement?
Certainly. So one that I've been closely engaged with, actually, and I think it would be of interest to your audience because of, again, the prioritization of modern slavery, of focusing on modern slavery issues in operations and supply chains, it's the STRT. So that's the Slavery and Trafficking Risk Template. So we're on the committee that's responsible for maintaining the template, so have good insights into, you know, how the tool has evolved over time and the value that it's bringing to corporate programs. But it's an open source free tool. It's available online at sraglobal.org. So I'm, you know, housed under a broader initiative called the Social Responsibility Alliance. But anyone who's, you know, interested in you know, exploring that tool further, you'll note that there's actually a case study of a business who's leveraged the tool within their own program, and it highlights the value that tool has brought to them. So in that particular instance, it was a business who used the STRT to launch a supplier engagement exercise on modern slavery issues. So this was a business who hadn't been engaging their suppliers on modern slavery issues. They understood that it was a priority for them to begin doing so, and they chose to do so by first piloting the STRT with a subset of their suppliers. And they found actually that it provided a really good entry point for them to do that. It fostered some really constructive conversations with their suppliers, and it enabled them to better understand which of their suppliers are engaged on these issues and which ones, you know, do they need to work a bit harder at those engagement issues. So that's certainly one that jumps to mind for me that I would bring to the attention of your audience. In terms of kind of best practices around supplier engagement, Ian, I don't know if I have an opportunity to maybe send some resources around to the audience afterwards, but certainly at Ascent, I mean, we host webinars frequently on this topic, so I'd be happy to draw attention to some of those. But you'll find that a lot of those webinars, they'll highlight, you know, some of the strategies that I've, you know, mentioned in my opening remarks. There's a number of others that I didn't bring to the table because I didn't want to bring too much information forward. I know we were sort of restricted in time, but around, for instance, the importance of picking up the phone and calling suppliers where a supplier is not, you know, engaging with a business on a human rights issue, the importance of you know, disaggregating suppliers if there's a supplier where that engagement is not taking place. What does that look like? You know, is it because, you know, have they started maybe the response but they haven't submitted it? Have they not accessed the response? Because I think depending on which bucket the supplier falls into, it can warrant a different follow-up action plan. Anyway, there's a few different, you know, other strategies that I would encourage, you know, audience members to consider as they think about how to scale programs, how to achieve high engagement rates with their suppliers. And you'll find a lot of those resources would help bring those forward.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Coming towards the end of our time, I'd like our panelists to think forward a little bit, think about what's coming up in the next few months, and specifically what they want to see more of in the coming months. So if we have the conversations again, we'll be having similar conversations again when we meet later in the year, but then also, you know, into next year. Sarah, what are you looking forward to seeing more of in the coming months?
Yeah. So for my side, and I don't think this will be a surprise to anyone just based on some of the things that I've highlighted already, but is the launch of additional, so the availability of additional open source supplier engagement tools that businesses can use to engage their suppliers on human rights issues. Again, I think there's tools that exist today that are bringing tremendous values to programs, but I think that there's a gap. And I would love in kind of the coming, you know, months, years to start seeing that gap narrow so that businesses have access to these open source tools that they need to really meaningfully and effectively engage their suppliers on these issues. And suppliers in turn are then able to manage these requests in a way that doesn't overrun or overburden their businesses, which in turn would you know, lead to better response rates. So
thanks, Sarah. Sure, thank you. And Sarah, just very briefly, questioner who was on a slightly poor lines asked, you mentioned a website just now in your previous answer. Can you remember which website it was? And just repeat that so that our questioner can Google it.
Certainly. So it's sraglobal.org. So SRA stands for the Social Responsibility Alliance.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. Okay, Shane, turning to you then. What are you hoping to see more of in the coming months? And perhaps then the successes that we could perhaps talk about if we have the conversation again next year.
It'd be nice if we could get government to be aligned to the challenges that businesses face, but that is real utopia stuff. If we could get them to understand the consequences of the decisions that they make, yeah, that would be great. Whether we'll be discussing that in a year would be a completely different matter.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to stop the discussion now as we have come towards the end of our time. I appreciate there's been a lot of webinaring today and, of course, more to come tomorrow. But thank you very much indeed to Sarah and to Shane for their time and insight this afternoon. We'll be in touch to share a recording of the webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. But for now, thank you for joining us, and I hope you found this session interesting. I'll be back in the morning at 10 a.m. UK time to discuss child labour monitoring and remediation with GTI and Mars. I hope you can join us. Until then, I hope the rest of your Wednesday goes well and stay safe.